Yesterday, toward the end of the talk, we were talking about oneness, the cessation of dualities, and the consequent cessation even of one. And then we talked a little about Kongan practice and how to approach Kongan practice and responding to Kongans, you know, not through a process of thinking and figuring out, but through really trying to let go of our ideas. Rest in openness, as Zen Master Jibong coined that phrase, rest in openness. And from there, an answer can appear. So today I'll just pick up where we left off in the poem and start with the next lines. So this is starting on stanza 27. Most of you probably already know that the poem itself does not contain stanzas. For ease of use, Zen Master Zhang Bong so broke it up into sections, four lines each usually. And so that's why we have those stanzas. So it goes like this. For the unified mind, in accord with the way, all self-centered striving ceases. Doubts and irresolutions vanish, and life in true faith is possible. The first line, for the unified mind in accord with the way, all self-centered striving ceases. What is this? What do you suppose is this unified mind, and why does self-centered striving cease? Anybody have any thoughts about that? Why unified mind? Of course, these are just words and translations. No ego, you said. Mm-hmm. That is what I thought. That this unified mind is the mind which, among other things, the distinction of a self has fallen away. So, no self-centered striving because there's no self. Likewise, doubts and irresolutions cease because there's no self to experience them. Irresolutions. I looked that up. I know what a resolution is. I wasn't sure about an irresolution. Irresolution is just a doubt or uncertainty. Yeah. Okay. So, self-centered striving ceases, doubts vanish, and life in true faith is possible. Next, with a single stroke, we are freed from bondage. Nothing clings to us, and we hold to nothing. All is empty, clear, self-illuminating, with no exertion of the mind's power. So, like some of the other promises in this poem, this sounds pretty darn good. A release from bondage, freed from bondage. What a relief. The bondage, though, of what? What sort of bondage?
Karma.
Karma. Sorry, who said karma? Oh yeah, Debbie. Yeah. And how does karma appear in our day-to-day lives?
Habits.
Habits of?
Anything and everything.
yeah, karma. Yeah, anything and everything. Yeah, we're conditioned. You know, karma is our conditioning. So here's what I thought. We're freed from bondage. Nothing clings to us, and we hold nothing. So with karma, it certainly makes sense with think in considering karma, it certainly makes things that sense that, you know, karma clings to us and we cling to karma, you know, our habits, like as Debbie said, we hold on to those. We're bonded deeply to them. And through this unified mind, we are freed from bondage. So what I thought in terms of bondage was, you know, who has never suffered? Have you ever suffered? Ever worried? Ever been challenged by painful circumstances? You know, even some so painful that really they have altered our life, maybe forever. Are we haunted by past mistakes and regrets? Life is really hard sometimes. So when I think of the bondage that Sung San was referring to, I think really of, you know, what else could he be referring to other than the life of dukkha, of incompleteness or unsatisfactoriness, this life of opposites where nothing is ever really feels complete. For that reason, you know, we suffer. Zen Master Jibong, when he, the way he worded suffering or dukkha, he called it contracted space. Contracted space. So not seeing the whole picture. So with a unified mind, in a single stroke, Sung San says we're freed from that. And all is empty, clear, self-illuminating. And there's no exertion necessary of our mind to perceive this or to churn and to determine and sort out what's happening. It's clear, which sounds just wonderful. And, you know, here I thought it might be a good time to throw in some counterpoint or perspective. You know, it almost sounds too good to be true. And Zen Master Zhongbong was talking about this when he was talking about the poem. He described enlightenment as being very highly esteemed. And when we read Zen stuff, there's a lot of stuff like this in there, you know. All is empty, clear, self-illuminating. You know, we hold on to nothing. We're freed from bondage. It sounds wonderful, but to me, it sounds almost too good to be true. Sounds almost like, you know, just in this stroke, we suddenly are completely free. It almost sounds like cheap grace, is one phrase I came up with for it, borrowing from Dietrich Bonhoeffer, cheap grace. Like, you know, suddenly we're rich. We win the lottery, and all is well. We never have to worry about money again. So is it really that easy? Maybe it is. So, you know, don't take my word for it. But I'm, you know, I'm reflecting some things Zhongbong said. You know, we can't just, and I'll get to that. You know, Buddhism teaches that anyone can wake up to freedom and that it can happen anytime. But, you know, Zhongbong Sansa on Tuesday, he pointed out quite beautifully that we can't just trade in our flawed small self for a troubles-free, shiny new self, as he called it. And, you know, after insight, our life still awaits us, as does, I would say, this uncharted path of the uncharted bodhisattva path, which more than likely is not pain-free. You know, Zhongbong Sansa was talking about, you know, being on the freeway and getting cut off. I think the person who in the BMW who cuts us off on the freeway is likely still going to annoy us. depending on the timing of and how we're feeling, you know. Our partner might annoy us, you know, the person that we love the most or hope to love the most. I have in mind, you know, using Sun San's word for the poem, you know, the imagined accomplished Taoist who responds effortlessly and harmoniously to every situation. You know, that idea, that kind of freedom and power, if you will, is so compelling. But I'm reminded, you know, some martial artist who steps out of the way of every attack, you know, perfectly, and no one is harmed. You know, I'm remembering my own time studying judo. This was half a lifetime ago. I practiced judo for 3 years. And my teachers were really, really good. And I think if I practiced judo for 30 years, I probably still could not. You know, they could still throw me on my butt pretty easily. They were just really good. So, you know, we can imagine that we would, you know, have such great skill that nothing touches us, nothing clings to us. But it's probably not exactly like that. You know, just because we study Zen doesn't mean that life won't throw us to the ground hard now and then. So also just as a mental exercise, you know, we can think about and suppose for a moment that, you know, a profound awakening soon awaits us, that it was going to happen soon. And, you know, maybe it will. But if we just put in a little more effort, then we're going to have that kind of experience. In this case, I think it's helpful to remember a couple of the adjectives that Anne Popesnaim used when describing this poem and its contents. You know, she said profound and radical. And I would ask, you know, am I ready for radical? And what radical truly is, some kind of radical reorienting to truth and to my life and to experience. Zhang Bong Sansa described, you know, someone he met who had an opening experience, and his life was, you know, altered, and he felt like he was in hell ever since. You know, everything bored him. He was trying to get back to that state. You know, it was something that he now was grasping at, not freedom really, but a kind of prison in a way that he had found himself in. So Buddhism is radical. And if we had an experience like that, would we want to let go of our cherished opinions and beliefs, our comforting habits and addictions, including our attachment to our idea of ourself? You know, our temple rules tell us to hurry up, hurry. But they also counsel us to understand where we're going and to watch our step. The Sung San's news, like Buddhist news, is good news. You know, keep in mind that Buddha said he worked on this project for many lifetimes, lifetime after lifetime. So we can be free, but we should be careful about imagining what freedom is and not let our minds get away, run away with us when we read something like this. I'm going to quote James Baldwin again, as I have in the past. James Baldwin said, freedom is hard to bear. He said he hadn't met very many people who truly wanted freedom. And he said, of those he had met, none of them were Americans. Where we cherish freedom, you know, the idea of it. He also said, and I'm quoting, we are capable of bearing a great burden once we discover that the burden is reality and arrive where reality is. So in setting aside our ideas as we practice, we can also set aside any ideals that we might have in mind and maintain some sobriety as we move step by step through our lives toward the truest experience of reality that we can attain. You know, Buddha taught the middle way, not some way of extremes. I remember reading, and I was reading about the Buddha's life, and you know, he had two principal disciples, Mahakashapa and Madhgalyayana, and one of them, you know, Somebody in a nearby town set up this contest, you know, put this special bowl on top of a tall pole and then greased the pole and said, you know, anyone, and the challenge was anyone who can get up the pole can keep this special bowl. So one of them just kind of flew into the air and got it. And he said, not correct, not correct. So Zen is the work of a lifetime or more. And as Zhang Bong told me once, and I've always remembered this, we're in it for the long haul. So, you know, we can wake up tomorrow, but you know, then what? Then what? There's that book with the title, you know, After Ecstasy, The Laundry. You know, that's still there, waiting for us. And I'm remembering too, you know, Chunul was one of our Korean ancestors who brought together or participated in bringing together the sort of the meditation, the Sudden schools and the Sutra schools in Korea. And he pointed out the necessity of, you know, sudden enlightenment or sudden awakening, after which there is gradual cultivation. So it's not one and done when that sort of thing happens. All right, I feel like I've been talking on top of a soapbox here. So I'll go into the next section. And here it is. Here, thought, and we're talking about this special place. Here, thought, feeling, knowledge, and imagination are of no value. In this world of suchness, there is neither self nor other than self. So here we see, again, this idea of no self and no not self. But, you know, the first line in this section is, here thought, feeling, knowledge, and imagination of no value. I think to say things are that we use to define ourselves, you know, our thoughts, our feeling, our so-called knowledge, are of no value, is a little hard to take. So I looked at a few other translations. Here's one. There, not a thought can be measured. Reason and emotion can't conceive it. In the Dharma realm of true thusness, there is neither other nor self. So that's a little different. It sounds a little different. It feels a little different. This second rendering suggests not that our relative characteristics are of no value, because they're beautiful in their own way, but rather that we cannot use them to grasp the absolute, which is outside of self and other, and outside of knowledge, feeling, thought. Okay. Now comes a few of the hallmark lines from this poem. This will be the last part that we talk about today. To come directly into harmony with this reality, just say, when doubt arises, not two. In this not two, nothing is separate, nothing is excluded. I'm going to just read that again. To come directly into harmony with this reality, this open realm of no divisions, no separation, just say, when doubt arises, not two. In this not two, nothing is separate, nothing is excluded. So, anybody have any comments about not two? Why not two? Anybody have any thoughts about not two? Two is dualistic, yeah. It's T-W-O, yeah. Uh-huh, it points to opposites. And he is saying just not to, say not to when doubts arise. So Charlie said to create suffering. Yeah.
What's the doubt for? What are we doubting?
Yeah, good question. What are we doubting? What would you say we might be? He's referring to when he said, "When just say when doubt arises, not to."
I don't know. Not two.
I'm thinking, you know, doubt means, you know, doubt refers to if some uncertainty about how things are. So here was my take on this instruction, not to. He tells us to say not to. So this struck me, as it did the author of that book, Faith or Trust in Mind, his name is Musong, you know, as being like a mantra, not to. When doubt arises, not to. That's and but unlike some repeated mantras, you know, we use mantras like Kwanzaa Bosal or the Great Irani or you know, don't know. Unlike those, some of those mantras, and unlike Wadu practice, you know, like a great question, like what is this or what am I? These practices help direct our attention away from our thoughts. Not to, on the other hand, has this clear content, not to. So to me, it's like a reality check, or as Musong wrote, a clarifier. So for when we're disoriented, when things seem murky, we can say, not to, and try to, in a sense, trust that that is a correct teaching, not to. If we're stuck in a situation that seems unclear, not to is clarifying. So this clarifier comes in the form of language, but like other signposts made of language, it points us to that which is beyond language. So on a profound level, not to can reorient us in the direction of the absolute, which is before thought, and where, as it's written in the poem, nothing is separate and nothing is excluded. It points us in that direction toward a reality of perfect harmony. On a more mundane level, I think not to can also be useful. Not to can help us get through ordinary mundane difficulties, such as when we're in conflict with someone that's close to us, and we're thinking that, for example, their way of looking at things is all wrong and beyond hope. You know, not to. We're not separate from them. There is validity in things as they are, including in this person's point of view. Another thing I want to point out about Sun San's recommended phrase, not to. He said not to. He did not write this. He did not say to come directly into harmony with this reality, just say when doubt arises, one. Like all things are one. Yesterday I talked about how one necessitates two or more, and that to make one is to make many. Sung San uses this negating adverb, not. And that's what I want to draw out. Because there are some Buddhist teachings which basically say, you know, not this, not this, not this. So it takes away everything that we might hold on to. And using this adverb, not, it takes away and avoids, it takes away, anything that we might grasp onto and helps us avoid landing on a conceptual idea, such as two, for example, or on one. He also didn't recommend we say, I am not two. Some of you know that our root teacher, Zen Master Sung San, taught the mind practice of don't know. And one of the things he taught for meditation practice was when we inhale, we say clear mind, clear mind, clear mind, and then don't know. He did not teach, you know, clear mind, I don't know. So he takes out that I and he just leaves don't know. And don't is also, negating word, you know, not knowing, not grasping, not thinking, don't know. And thus he avoided the dependence on the idea of a self. So not to does not contain I. Okay. That's a little, I think, wordy. Does anybody have any thoughts about that, about not to, and what that means, and why?
I wonder if, if we talk about that one mind place, and it's not, it's, when we use the word not, it's getting rid of.
Mm-hmm.
Because our essence, our Buddha nature, one mind, has nothing there. It's clear. So all our thoughts, all our attachments, they are additions. So really there is nothing for us to add. It's just simply getting rid of or letting go of all that stands between us and what we already have. Uh-huh. And so when we say not to, is when the absence of our thoughts and our attachments, we're already one. That feels like the oneness. Therefore, if we have two, already our thoughts, our desires, or whatever is already an impediment, it's already in our way, and it's simply just shedding those things off. Therefore, if there's nothing to attain, we already have it. It's just getting rid of this ton of things that constantly arise, and looking beyond that to find our true nature.
Yeah, so in not to, we, like you say, there is letting go, and there is letting go of opposites, not to. And it's also, in saying not to, it's also, he might have said, and not one either, neither one nor two. So nothing to hold on to. And again, as soon as we make one, we have two or more. So, yeah, he just says not. Maybe he just sort of said, just say not. Nope. Okay. All right. Then there is one more section for today. He writes, no matter when or where, enlightenment means entering this truth. And this truth is beyond extension or diminution in time or space. A single thought is 10,000 years. So, no matter when or where, enlightenment means entering this truth. This section has a ring to me of universality to it. So, no matter what, no matter when or where, to wake up means entering this truth, which he is trying to convey in this poem. So, other renderings go like this. The wise ones of the ten directions have entered this great understanding. And there's another translation. Enlightened beings everywhere all return to the source. So all of these lines seem to point to the same thing, the same truth that he is trying to describe. And so directly attaining the truth of not to, which is beyond time and space, is the consequence for all who search deeply for the truth. So there is this truth to be found. This, in a sense, what did he call it earlier? Later in the poem, and it might be, I'll be talking about this tomorrow, he calls it the final reality. So this is the true teaching. In the Heart Sutra, it says, there's this lines which said, I think it's talking about the Heart Sutra Mantra, and it said, mantra, and it says, which is true, not false. So he's saying, there is this truth to see, and it is like this. And all those who experience enlightenment see it as this, as it is.